Hello, welcome back to the Humans of ID podcast, Careers and Professional Development Edition, hosted by the ID Student Organizers, Career and Professional Team of the Department of International Development at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I'm Shivani, your podcast host for today's episode, where I have the privilege of hosting Professor Naila Kabir, an esteemed expert in gender and development at the Department of International Development. Professor Kabir holds the position of Faculty Associate at LSE's International Inequalities Institute and serves on the governing board of the Atlantic Fellowship for Social and Economic Equity. Her extensive professional background includes advisory roles with international agencies such as the World Bank and UNDP, as well as bilateral agencies like DFID and IDRC. In addition to her illustrious career, Professor Naila Kabir is also an accomplished author, having penned several influential books that delve into the complexities of gender and development. Join us as we learn about Professor Kabir's journey and gain insights into the field of development. So, hello, Professor. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Professor Kabir, we are thrilled to have you here on our podcast today, especially considering your exceptional professional background in the realm of international development. So, without further ado, I would like to ask you my first question. What led you to the field of development?
I think when I was deciding what discipline I would enter when I became a student, I think my preference was for economics. And so when I first came to the LSE, which was as an undergraduate, I actually joined the economics department. So I did my first degree in economics. I went off to a university college, did my second degree in economics, came back to LSE, registered for a PhD, also to do economics. And somewhere along that line, I decided I was not cut out to be an economist, that I didn't have what it takes, the kind of worldview to be an economist. And so halfway through my PhD, I switched to the Department of Population Studies. And the virtue of the Department of Population Studies was that it was interdisciplinary. So it had a lot of demographers, but it also had people who were anthropologists, historians. You know, it was not a hidebound disciplinary department, and so I felt quite comfortable here. And then from population studies, I started to hear about very interesting work being done at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex, where there was a whole new movement around bringing gender and feminism into development. And I thought, that's where I want to go. And so when I finished my PhD, I actually did manage to join the Institute of Development Studies, where I became a part of the group of feminists who were critiquing development for its gender blindness.
That's remarkable. And to what extent would you say that your experiences in India and Bangladesh shaped your decision to pursue this path?
It was absolutely crucial. I think even when I did the degree in economics, you know, my option was development economics. But I didn't recognize the countries I came from in the kind of development economics that was being taught, because as you know, a lot of it is taught through abstract models, which can apply to almost any part of the world. So I kind of wanted to be a bit at home, but I couldn't see home in the kind of what I was being taught. It was very different in population studies because they were not, you know, tied to any particular model. They did do a lot of statistics and number crunching, but as I said, they did a lot of field work. And actually, the moment I decided I was going to leave economics was when I told my PhD supervisor that I wanted to go and do field work in Bangladesh. And he said, economists don't do field work. They work with large data sets. You know, they number crunch large data sets. And he gave me Gary Becker to read. And I had actually been reading anthropologists. And so I thought, you know, I'm not cut out for this. And that's, I went into population studies, and then I went and did a year and a half field work in Bangladesh. So I managed to do it my own way.
Wow, that is truly fascinating and inspiring. So, zooming out and reflecting on everything you have done, what would you highlight as your main accomplishment?
It's very interesting, but I think my main accomplishment was probably my first book. And, you know, I've written a lot of things since then, and some of them have been widely cited. But almost by accident, and because I was working with this group of feminists who were thinking anthropologically, ethnographically about the Global South, the kind of ideas that I got from them were at the beginning of a wave, if you like. So I was there at the beginning of a wave. And so when I published this book, it was a collection of essays, and people told me afterwards that it really fitted a sort of niche. You know, there was something missing in what was being taught. And it brought theory and empirical data together. But I was writing as someone who knew some parts of the Global South firsthand. And so it drew very much on examples and, you know, on evidence that people who were studying development could recognize. You know, when I said I couldn't recognize home in what I was being taught in economics, it, you know, those models could apply anywhere. You just change a few variables. Whereas I think drawing on, you know, solid examples from different parts of the world I didn't know, but I had read about, I think spoke to people about their own realities. And so that book, Reverse Realities, was, you know, you never think it, do you, when you write something, that this one is going to be more important than anything else. But it has remained, you know, something that students like, and I feel very proud of it.
And as you should, your book, Reverse Realities, is a groundbreaking work.
Thank you.
Professor, I would like to take this opportunity to mention that you are an inspiration for many women, especially women of color from Global South, like me, who are navigating their paths in the so-called first world. So when you were trying to navigate your path in the Global North, what were the challenges that you faced?
As a student, I didn't notice discrimination, you know, because I was with a lot of other students, and we were fighting racism, but we were fighting it out there rather than within the university. I was just aware that what I was being taught seemed to have very little connection with lived reality. I think it's when I started to work professionally that I began to realize that my identity as a woman of color, you know, someone from the South Asian subcontinent, mattered. When I joined IDS, there was absolutely no black person there. I was in an institution that was studying development and that was made up almost entirely of white and men from Latin America, etc., but there were no, you know, nobody from Africa, nobody from Asia, nobody from the Caribbean. And it was a while before they appointed the next black person. In fact, I remember the director of my institute came up and said, "Nala, you're no longer the, you know, only black person in this institute. We've appointed someone from Kenya, a guy." I think he lasted about, I don't know, 10 weeks, and then he went off and got another job, not because of anything. So I think there was a real struggle, first of all, because I was working on feminism, and that was still a very marginal activity, so we were seen as slightly, you know, on the margins. Secondly, because it was the culture of the place, you know, it was not hospitable. I would say it was not hospitable. By the time I left, which was many years, it had become very diverse, you know, and I think it had people from different parts of the world. It had a good mix of men and women. And you could tell just how students, by the way, were all coming from the Global South, most of them, right? So it was a very white academic staff teaching, largely students from different places. And overcoming that meant overcoming the assumption that somehow your take on things was not going to be as objective, as rigorous, you know, that, yes, I think I had to go through having to prove yourself in a sense. And because I was a very lone person, I didn't do it in a very confrontational way, you know, because what do you do as a lone voice? But it was about being lonely, really, you know, because it was, there were not that many people that you could talk to about how you felt about things. But I know when I started, the first teaching I did was to teach a course called Women, Men, and Development. And we brought in people from all over the world for 3 months residential course. And somebody else directed the first one, I directed the rest. And I remember the second one that I directed, there was a woman from Uganda, Evelyn, and she came up to me and she said, oh, I'm so glad to see you, because she was the first time in Britain. And she was very anxious about not getting things right. So, and I suppose there are a lot of Asians in Uganda, you know, so it made her feel sort of reassured. And I don't think that's a one-off experience. I think, you know, when you arrive at a place and nobody looks like you, or not exactly like you, I think you're far more anxious about how you're going to fit in, and how, even if you're only there for 3 months. So I think that thing about having a very much more representative body of academics working with, you know, with representatives of the people they were teaching, and that was important. And I will say that Ali has changed a lot over the years.
That's actually good to know that things are changing. And as you rightly pointed out, a representative body of academics is extremely crucial for any institution. Thank you so much, Professor, for sharing these valuable insights and experiences from your journey. So, talking further about your journey, is there any instance or experience that left a lasting impact on your work? And would you like to share that with us?
Yes, I think so. You know, as I said, when I was doing the economics, it was all quantitative, you know, large scale and secondary data, you know, not data you had collected yourself. When I went to do field work as a part of population studies, I had no background in qualitative research. So although I went and did so-called field work in a village for a year and a half, I actually just carried out surveys. I didn't know what else to do. You know, I didn't know how to go and do interviews, etc. But I lived there, and you kind of learn a bit about rural life by living there. But really, I came away from that village with all my quantitative biases intact. The next piece of research I did was to go, decided I was going to talk to garment workers in East End of Bangladeshi garment workers in the East End of London, Bangladeshi garment workers in Bangladesh. And I decided to take a very qualitative approach, and I taught myself, you know, what you needed to do for interviews. And interestingly, the framework that I used for the work that I did there was to take the economic model of supply-side decision-making, right? But rather than use quantitative variables to model it, I decided to ask people, like, when did you hear about this job? Who did you discuss it with? Who opposed you? Who supported you? What happened the first day you went to work? What did they talk to you about? So I tried to take the whole process of supply-side decision-making, as economists call it, but give it a kind of an ethnographic feel. And talking to these people, you know, women in Bangladesh particularly, but also the women in London, brought home to me how much wiser they were than I had thought. You know, these are women who are from the countryside, you know, often with very little education. But the way that they articulated what they wanted to convey, and in Bengali and maybe in other languages, the use of metaphor, you know, very colorful use of metaphor. So the one I've used is I asked a woman worker in Bangladesh, why do employers want to only employ women? When in this country, usually it is men who are given favored for jobs. And she said, the employers know, no, we women, she said, are like birds with a broken wing. The employers know that we cannot go very far and that they can pay us less. And I thought, you know, she's captured very important labor market insights in this very vivid metaphor. And And I find that talking to people, so even now when I write, I find it very hard not to quote people directly, because I think their words convey both that these are thinking, acting, reflective people, perfectly able to articulate what they think, but also they have a very nice way of articulating it. You know, it's a use of metaphor that we don't see in this country in everyday language. You know, it's at least reserved for special occasions. Whereas I think in Bangladesh, people often express themselves through metaphors. And that ability to, and I remember when I did my first article, a colleague at IDS, Institute of Development Studies, said to me, is that how Bangladeshi women talk? And I said, yes, but in Bengali. I think he couldn't believe that they were able to express themselves so well.
Yeah, that's very interesting to know, and it's also very humbling to know this.
Yeah.
And I completely agree with you about them being able to share mm-hmm. large realities mm-hmm. in simple words mm-hmm. and in their own words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Based on your extensive experience, what advice would you give to ID students pursuing their masters and aspiring to become academics or researchers like you, or aiming to work with international organizations and NGOs, which you also have worked with?
Mm-hmm. What advice? I think this sounds a little corny, but I think doing the work, if you want to have a good life, I think doing the work that you believe in, you know, I think being inspired to have your work mean something beyond publishing in refereed journals, you know, so, and I think you can get published in refereed journals, but I think, and I don't think everybody has that. You know, at IDS, it was very interesting. A very nice colleague of mine, you know, we were divided into different groups. So there was a participation group, a gender group, an industrialization group, a trade group. And this friend of mine, he was an economist, he said, you know, in IDS, there are two groups that are ideologically driven, the gender group and the participation group. And I know what he meant. The people who worked in these two groups had an added commitment to their work, which went beyond getting it right for academia. You know, there was a commitment to making things change in a kind of bottom-up way, if you like.
Thank you so much, Professor. You've also been working on your upcoming book titled Renegotiating Patriarchy, Gender Agency, and the Bangladesh Paradox. Mm-hmm. Could you provide us some insights into it, and when can we read it?
Mm. When can we read it will depend on LSE Press and on my ability. I told you I don't like giving up people's words, so it's way too long. I could cut it in half by just chopping out all the quotations, but, you know, that's not easy. So the book is about, the Bangladesh Paradox is about the fact that when Bangladesh became independent in 1971, it was one of the poorest countries in the world, very high rates of population growth because of high fertility rates, a highly extreme patriarchy, and a very bad governance, you know, very regarded as incompetent. But within about a decade and a half, a lot of things began to change on the social front, right? Its fertility came down very rapidly, education went up. And all of this happened, A, at a rate that was faster than India and Pakistan, which were richer and were growing faster. But more than that, these changes were pro-poor and gender equitable. So what we saw is, along with the decline in fertility rates, we didn't see that adverse sex ratio that we were seeing in India, where that had sex-related abortions. We saw a closing of mortality rates, gender differences in mortality among under five children, which persisted in neighboring countries. So along with these changes on the social front, we also saw changes on the issue of gender equality. And lots of people have written lots of things about how that happened. But I feel that those who've tried to explain it have tended to focus on policy actors or on, you know, the big people. So on corporations, you know, garment industry, the donors, NGOs, etc. But I kind of felt there was another story to be told, which was what was it that drove ordinary men and women to change their behavior? And, you know, what was it? After all, the practices were, you know, inherited in the past. They had inherited from history. These were practices, you know, discriminating against daughters, you know, all of these things. That was always been there. But why did it change? So this book is actually using ethnographic, anthropological, secondary data, and my own research to explain change around the reproductive domain, fertility, education, and so on, the productive domain, livelihoods, and so on. But also, the other part of the paradox, which we don't talk about, is that this was also a period where we saw the rise of a very orthodox version of Islam. So Bangladesh has always had a very tolerant version of Islam, a syncretic version of Islam. But with the rise of the petrodollar and the power of the Gulf countries, etc., and migrants going to the Middle East, we did see a lot of import of a different kind of religion, which was far less friendly to these changes. And so part of the paradox that I'm trying to explain is how did these changes take place nevertheless? You know, we see evidence of this change, but it hasn't stopped women from going out to work. It hasn't stopped them sending their daughters to school, not just madrasas, but, you know, government schools and so on. So I think that too is interesting because, you know, Islam is always singled out as being the most conservative of all religions. But this is a Muslim majority country, and it was able to make these changes happen. So it's very much a people's history of the Bangladesh paradox.
It sounds really fascinating, and we are truly looking forward to it. Lastly, your association with LSE spans from being an undergrad completing your BSc to being a PhD student and now a professor. As this long journey is now coming to an end, how do you feel looking back?
You know, I feel a lot of affection for LSE. I mean, the LSE I was as a student and the LSE that we have today, there's huge change. You know, we saw at the end of the 70s, we saw Thatcherism and, you know, a lot of dismantling of the welfare state, of education as a right, you know, user fees have gone up. And all of these things changed the character of a university. But I think I have a loyalty to the Institute of Development Studies because I was there straight after my PhD. And I have a particular loyalty to LSE because, if you like, I grew up here. Do you know what I mean? I came here and I came to this country, and almost within 2 years I arrived at LSE. And so I became British. You know, I became a British person. I became a Londoner through my years at the LSE. And what I learned in the classroom and what I learned in the bar and what I learned on the streets formed me. You know, so I have a lot of affection for this place, and I'm really glad I kind of ended up here after such a long roundabout journey.
And we are glad about that too, Professor. Your journey has touched so many students' lives at LSE for over a decade now. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your journey and provide guidance to ID students. It was an honor to have you as a guest on the Humans of ID podcast. Thanks to your insights, today we were able to delve into various possibilities, perspectives, and challenges encountered while venturing into the professional realm of international development. I'm sure your journey will serve as a guiding light for students as they embark on their professional journey beyond LSE. I would also like to give a special thanks to all our listeners, the Department of International Development, Maya Bullen and Andrea Marino Mayayo, all the ID student organizers behind this project, including Michaela Levitt, our podcast editor and producer, Razan Awad, our script co-editor and social media creator, and Valentina Papu, our script co-editor and podcast blurb writer. Please make sure to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or your preferred platform and follow us at the LSE Department of International Development on Instagram and LinkedIn. Send us any comments, suggestions, questions, and thoughts on what you would like to hear from us by going to the link in the International Development Instagram bio.
Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore further insights on how to get started in the development sector. This podcast will continue with special guests covering fields of international organizations, governments, NGOs, and think tanks. The next podcast will be a studio episode. Until next time, this has been your host, Shivani.